Okay.
Log Talk Radio.
Well, welcome to Gather Round. Tonight we're talking gardening with so far one expert, and we have another one due to call in. But Lisa Bolivar from Facebook page Heirloom Herbs and Edible Flowers is with us. Hi, Lisa.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm great. You just heard my neighbor's dog.
That's your neighbor's dog? If I turn on the speaker here, my dogs will join.
Oh, they're
we can
like
have a dog conference.
Maybe. She's a very nice dog. And it's like if somebody goes by, she barks. If the kids are playing, but they're not playing with her and she's tied, she'll bark. She's just good, but sometimes it gets pretty loud.
Yeah, well, that's her job.
Yeah, well, exactly. You know, so, hey, sometime maybe I'll have a dog again, although every time I mention the D-O-G word, Screech especially goes into some kind of hyper something. But just tell us a little bit about yourself, Lisa, and what you're doing, and then we'll get off into other questions.
Okay. Well, I kind of decided last spring after people were knocking on my door several times a week that I needed to try to make a living out of what I was doing for free, and that was giving people tours of my yard, which is totally edibly landscaped. I literally had strangers coming by asking to to learn about what I had planted around my house. And I'm lucky, I live in a tropical climate. I'm in South Florida, where I can grow something to eat all year round. There's something going here. I have about 60 different things planted on what's called a zero lot. Years ago, I had a business in North Florida where I supplied gourmet restaurants with edible flowers and herbs. So I revived that business, which is Heirloom Herbs and Edible Flowers, and I've added hard-to-find tropical fruits to that. And I'm starting a lecture series at the end of this month on how to create a sustainable yard, and I want to start a revolution. I want to get everyone to plant what I'm calling victory yards in the spirit of the victory gardens that came about with our grandparents at this point after World War II, where we were growing our own food, sharing with our neighbors, building communities, and we're a lot healthier than we are today with all the junk we eat.
For sure.
So I want to start a revolution, and I've got a background in agricultural research. I was an assistant in agriculture at Auburn University back in the 80s, before I went into journalism full-time. And so I've got somewhat of a background. But most of it's been, you know, try and fail and succeed and learning what works and what doesn't. And then as a gourmet cook, you know, I like to do things from around the world.
Right.
So I'm hoping
would you,
to be able
would you, before you continue, would you explain to us what a zero lot is?
A zero lot, it's pretty depressing having moved here from 5 acres, but it's my front yard is 20 feet deep. My side yard on either side between the houses, the total space is about 8.5, 9 feet, and that's the neighbor's yard and mine. The backyard is probably 35 feet deep, so it's teeny tiny, and I still have more than 60 things planted. Fruit trees and herbs and edible shrubs and flowers and then I have what I call scratch and sniff plants. I live in an association that has, you know, the people that walk around with rulers measuring grass and complaining about every little thing, and I have an association friendly yard, at least now I do. So I'd like to teach other people how to do this, and they say, oh, my association would never let me grow vegetables in my front yard garden plot. Oh, yes, they will. If you learn to do it in a way that's attractive, you can feed yourself.
Yeah. And how did you come about to get your you actually have a sign they gave you.
Well, yeah, that's kind of a story. I have one of my neighbors doesn't understand the lifestyle, the green lifestyle. and complained several times to code enforcement and the local law enforcement about all my trees that I planted, which I planted for passive cooling around the house. I just happened to choose fruit trees.
Mm-hmm.
And the sheriff's deputies would show up, look over my fence, and then come back later with their families taking notes on what I was doing, and code enforcement did the same thing. And one day after several code enforcement people showed up, another group showed up in my yard, very official looking with clipboards. And they were walking around my yard. I went out, you know, afraid that, okay, now these people are going to say, cut your trees.
Right.
So I went out there with great dread, and they looked at me and said, well, I was the only person to ever meet all 60 points on their list to qualify as a wildlife habitat Florida-friendly yard, which means everything is passive and xeriscaped and using rain barrels for water off the roof. And they wanted me to come teach classes, but in order to do that, you have to be certified as a master gardener, which sounds good. But once you get that certification, my understanding is you cannot be paid for your lectures, and I want to make a living or somewhat of a living doing my lectures. So I'd rather just be called, you know, the neighborhood eccentric and make a little money with it. So
well, you know what? That's true. And I see sort of where they're coming from, because the Master Gardener course is excellent. And they want you to pay back. Well, you pay a minimum fee to take the course, but they want you to, you know, you have to agree to put in so many hours. But then they do have this thing about being paid. And people, I think, if they have all the qualifications you have, and if you put Master Gardener along with it, I think you might be able to be paid. I'm not sure, though. I know that you can't just go out as a Master Gardener and, you know, have that as your whole promo and get paid.
Right.
But it is a wonderful course. I'd advise anybody for their own sake to take it. Go to your extension office in whatever state
you're in. I love
the
extension office. I really love extension agents, and I've worked with quite a few of them in Alabama, who, of course, were coming in to look at the research we were doing in the ag department.
Mm.
I was unfortunate enough at Auburn to work right next to the food lab, the food science lab, which meant they'd walk into the lab and say, okay, we're testing this or that crop. You have to come taste it. And one day they were doing like 20-something varieties of boiled peanuts, which to me tastes like snot. Can I say that on the radio?
Oh, yeah, you can say that. Oh,
yeah,
my goodness.
Okay, it tastes like snot. They're slimy and awful, and they had salty snot and sweet snot and hot
snot. Oh.
And I had to rate it all, and, of course, you can imagine what I had to say about it. But I picked up some skills while working there that I use to this day.
Right.
And one of the things I'd like to tell people who might be listening is that when you plant and you're thinking your landscape versus a garden, I kind of equate our traditional gardens with the military. We line our vegetables up like they're in some sort of a platoon. These straight lines. And, you know, let's be nonconformists for once and use shapes and colors and textures in our planting. And one of the tricks I learned while at Auburn University was from the horticulturalist, is when you plant in a bedding situation, plant in a triangle. So everything you do is going to be a group of three.
Right.
With a plant at each corner. And you can play with that. You can interlap different plants and textures and colors in, you know, different triangular forms. And it's much more pleasing to the eye than anything that you would do in a square or a row or a single, you know, a single row in your garden.
Okay.
So if any of you have ever planted flowers in your flower bed and they just didn't look as pretty as what you saw in the landscape, it's probably because you put them in a straight line.
Yeah. I've seen some things with curves that look nice, but true. My parents had large, large gardens when I was growing up, but they had the land for it too, but it was everything was in rows. And I remember it's just like, well, that's the way it was. But you can get so much more in your space when you don't plant in those rows.
Yeah, it's amazing what you can do when you're not so rigid. That's right.
Yeah.
That goes for other things in life as well.
Exactly. But, we're for flexibility, right, Lisa?
Yeah, flexibility and a little bit of chaos is good for everyone, I think.
Exactly. Well, now, when you're doing the triangle, it could be any size, right? And then you can intersect them.
Right.
So, yeah, I've heard the three plants, rather than two or four, it pleases our eye more.
It's kind of a magic number. I mean, it's got all sorts of implications if you know anything about world religions and philosophy.
Yeah, triad.
Yeah, the triad is, you've got the Trinity in Christianity, but you know, it's a magic number. And if you can work off three of everything, then you'd be amazed at what you can create. I wrote a story back in the 80s for Florida Living Magazine on night gardening. And what night gardening is working with shapes and flowers that bloom, or things that bloom, or foliage that has lighter colors, like your lamb's ear has a silver-colored leaf, and then you've got moon flowers, which are a type of morning glory.
They're one of my all-time favorites. I can never get enough moonflowers. Oh, God, I love those.
So during the day, you've got your geometric shapes planted in triangles and whatever, with whites and yellows worked in, working some Nicotania, which comes in reds and other colors. And then when the sun sets and the moon comes out, stroll through your gardens, because everything that's white is going to reflect moonlight. And then with the Nicotania and some of these night-blooming jasmines, you'll have a scent that you don't have during the day.
Right.
So your garden can be, you know, tickle your senses 24/7.
Right, as a moon garden. And
right.
Yeah, yeah.
And how
then,
cool is that, right?
Really. And then when you have it all interspersed with yummy things to eat, including many of these flowers, do you want to talk a little bit about the edible flowers? And then we'll get into herbs.
Sure. Well, there's a lot of flowers that are edible. The one that most people are familiar with is the viola. And some people call them pansies. I'm originally from New England, and we have this little viola called the Johnny Jump Up. And you can take those and use them in salads and stir fries and candy them by painting egg white and powdered sugar onto them and letting them dry. They're pretty on cupcakes and cakes and ice cream and this type of thing. And there's also roses that are edible. Now, I need to caution anybody listening that you don't just go buy a rose from a florist and go make a sauce out of it, because your commercial rose growers use systemic poisons in order to keep, you know, bugs from eating the roses. So if you're going to do culinary rose cooking, you need to grow your own or go to an organic farmer who is growing roses for culinary uses for the gourmet chefs. And those are usually a Floribunda old-fashioned rose that's very, very high in scent. They're not going to be your tea roses that have been hybridized to a point. I don't know if you've ever noticed pretty, pretty roses with no scent.
No scent whatsoever. And I mean, it's nothing like those wonderful old-fashioned ones, especially like the viney ones that hang over a fence and just almost knock you out with that sweetness. But, I mean, it's not offensive sweet. It's just wonderful.
How could a flower be offensive?
Well, sometimes, I'll take that back.
I've known a few.
I've smelled a few that maybe it's just like so much, sort of like a funeral where there's so many flowers and the smell just
That could be all the ladies in perfume, too, so you've got to...
That mixed with or something.
The gardenias kind of make me flip out, but that's not something that, you know...
A tiny bit of gardenia, I think, is beautiful, and a tiny bit to wear, I'm good. Preferably outside, where there's lots of air moving.
I can have a breeze blow across the neighbor's gardenia bush, and I get an immediate sinus headache, but that, you know, everyone's different.
Oh, yeah, well, sure, everybody's got their own little things, but I'm with you. The old-fashioned roses, hey, go for those.
Well, lately I've been cooking with lavender.
I used to have lavender, like what you were saying earlier with the sweets with on the cakes or cupcakes or in the frosting or something. So what have you been doing with it?
Well, I know a lot of your listeners are vegan, so everyone who's vegan, put your fingers in your ears. I've been doing a fish dish. You take a chunk of halibut. Am I cracking you up? Take a chunk of halibut and you smear Dijon mustard on one side of it. And you've got probably a quarter cup of panko breadcrumbs to a tablespoon of culinary lavender blossoms that you grind that up in your spice grinder and mix it with the panko. Then you press that into the one side of fish and lightly fry it until it's golden brown. Flip the fish over and finish. But then I serve that usually with the boiled finger potatoes that are fork tender and put the potatoes into the oil that the fish had just cooked in. Meanwhile, I'm melting a stick of butter to a tablespoon, again, of ground lavender and a tablespoon of your favorite honey. Make sure it's local honey. All the other honey comes out of China, and we don't want to do that. But then drizzle that over your potatoes as you serve it. It's a wonderful meal. It makes your house smell delightful, but make sure you don't have to drive anywhere because lavender is a sedative, and I tell you what, when I make this, my husband and I sleep like rocks after dinner. But it's absolutely wonderful.
But I would say for those of us who are vegan, I mean, now you ground it up and mixed it with the panko breadcrumbs.
Right.
So, yeah.
So what else could you do with it? You tell me you're vegan. What would you do with that, the simple panko lavender? What would you smear that on to?
What I might do, depending on what kind of veggie burgers I was concocting, I might just toss them in it before I put them in the skillet.
What about firm tofu? Can you bread and fry tofu?
You can't. I'm not a tofu person myself, but I've used it. I'll do like tofu crumble for breakfast kind of thing when we're camping. We like that instead of scrambled eggs. But tofu, yeah, if I were to fry it, I would have to have it in very small chunks. But yeah, there would be no reason not to just dip it in that.
Why not?
Yeah.
The sauce with the honey.
Yeah.
I have to say my husband is allergic to milk products, so we use a vegan butter substitute that is soy based instead of butter, and we've really gotten so. When I go out to eat and I have real butter, it doesn't taste good to me anymore, so I really go back to the vegan stuff.
Wow.
When you're listening to some of the recipes I might give you, then, you know, think about how can you adapt that to your vegan lifestyle?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you can. Everything doesn't have to be exactly by the recipe. That's, you know, you get ideas.
Now, tell me, do vegans drink beer?
Sure.
Okay,
and
here's some ideas for you.
well, some are more strict than others. Like somebody says, I mean, there's no way that we can live the life that we're living now, particularly in this country, and not put anything in our bodies that hasn't connected with something to do with animals. A lot of beer and different whiskeys and things are aged in barrels that have been either used for or have been, what do I want to say, aged with some type of meat but ash, bone ash products.
I didn't know
that. Some people won't. There's actually a website and all of this, and I think a Facebook group for people who are vegan for the wines and other kinds of alcoholic drinks that really are vegan, that haven't been through the cast, that have the ashes and things like that.
I bring it up is if you can make a beer batter, which is just basically whatever type of flour you like to use beer with maybe a pinch of salt or whatever, some of the edible flowers that you can take the blossoms and swirl it in the batter and then fry it, make a fritter out of it, are basil blossoms, calendula, carnations. Chive blossoms are yummy.
Yeah.
And those types of things. Did you know that you could eat those flowers?
Yeah. And also, so when you're talking fritters, we can go right into the herbs, because herbs go in fritters just
they're wonderful.
Wonderfully top, well, yeah.
Top chives and different things. Have you ever eaten a nasturtium blossom?
Have I ever eaten a what?
Nasturtium.
I don't think so. I've heard that they're edible, but I don't think I've had any.
Oh, you can eat the leaves as well as the blossom. They're kind of peppery.
Right.
And they're good in salads, and of course you don't eat cheese, but I like to put cottage cheese with maybe some fruit or tuna fish into nasturtium blossoms and serve that.
Mm.
I also use similar stuffings for tulip blossoms. The tulip petals, you can also eat those. They just chop those into a salad, and they kind of taste like English peas. But again, you've got to be careful, because the bulbs that are coming out of the Netherlands and other places are grown, once again, with systemic. So it's one of those things that you have to grow them yourself, let them grow a year, and then come into bloom the second time before you start eating them.
Okay.
But if you're in a northern climate where you can have beautiful tulips and you don't have to dig them up and refrigerate them like I do.
Yeah.
To get them to bloom again, that's a wonderful source in your yard and very colorful in your salads. Arugula blossoms.
Mm.
You know, if you're growing your arugula and it goes, you know, it bolts and goes to blossom, don't fret over that, because the blossoms are just as good in salads.
Okay, so is there anything that might be sort of common that you could grow that you don't want to eat the blossoms? While the flower or herb itself is fine, the blossoms would not be good for you?
I'd have to do some research on that, because I tend to eat most everything
that
I grow.
Right.
I try to choose the plants that you can do that with.
Mm-hmm.
One of the edible flowers that I like to use is, you don't really grow for the flower, it's the opposite of what you're saying. You grow for the leaves, and that's scented geraniums, the Pelargonium species.
Mm.
That's part of my scratch and sniff garden. They're originally from South America, and they don't do too well in Florida in the garden soil. I think it's too hot and steamy. But what they do traditionally is, you'll take your scented geranium, which can smell like roses or peppermint or ginger or citrus, and you put them in a decorative clay pot in front of your front door or in your walkway, where people, as they walk by, will brush the plant.
Mm.
And brushing the plant, it'll release these wonderful scents. Well, you can also make sauces and jellies and salads from the leaves, but my favorite thing is the rose-scented geranium, to use them in baking. And I'll line a angel food cake pan and make an angel food cake.
Oh.
Which will then be infused with this wonderful rose scent and flavor, and I'll serve that with a cup of Earl Grey tea and freshly whipped cream with a little bit of rose water in it.
Okay. I'm just getting where I can eat things with rose flavoring again. And in fact, I had been gifted with some rose tea, and I only have one left, and I don't know. I've been looking. I must get to an Indian store, and Indian Pack store will probably have it, because it was wonderful. At one point,
was it a Twinings product?
I don't believe so. It was in a cylinder.
Okay.
Right.
I'll have to look for that, because the only rose tea I was familiar with came from England, and they've stopped making it. So I buy a bottle of rose water now, basically, because I don't grow roses in my yard, and then put a sprinkle or two in my tea. It tastes the same.
Yeah.
But
it was really good. But one time I had had, it was at a ritual for the cakes and ales. Somebody had fixed some, just like candy, rose candy, and he had really, he probably went by the recipe, but it was a lot of the rose flavoring in it. And I just about, I mean, it was way too much. And everybody else was just loving it and eating more. And that, it took me a long time to get back to where, yeah, hey, the tea is good. I mean, in fact, the tea is excellent.
Well, it has this appeal for women, and I can't really quote off the top of my head what it does for us, but it is something that medicinally is supposed to impact us positively. I would caution anyone listening not to just go ahead and try these things, but because you never know what you're going to be allergic to. But do your research online.
Research.
Cross-reference your edible flowers with the word medicinal and see if it has an impact on your body one way or another. Of course, usually you have to eat a ton of whatever it is for it to have it impact you in a negative way, unless, of course, you're allergic and you're not going to know that.
Well, right. Or unless you know, if sometimes if you eat something and you don't seem to have any adverse reactions, but, you know, if you keep eating it, some things build up in you.
Right.
So, you know, we're just saying what we've done, what works for us, making suggestions, but you're on your own for research. And
Right. Well, daylilies are good, too. Can you grow daylilies where you are?
Yes.
Oh, they're wonderful. And they're good laxatives. They could be used as a laxative. So don't eat too many of them.
Okay.
But I like to serve them with bib lettuce and sweet onion in a peach yogurt type sauce.
Okay, now you're talking about the actual flower itself.
Yeah, the daylily,
right,
the flower.
Right, the
daylily, you can also
stuff them
and fry them.
Well,
they're a traditional ingredient in Chinese hot and sour soup as well.
Mm. What about squash blossoms? Do you cook those?
What did you say?
Squash blossoms.
Squash blossoms. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes.
Same idea.
That's like a Native American thing maybe. But if you're going to do that, you want to make sure that you've got enough squash so that, because if you take the blossom off, there
you're
will be no
squash. Yeah.
Right. So.
Right.
You maybe plant a few extra plants just for the blossoms or just for the squash, and know
right.
that you can't have both of the same. That's always fascinated me, and I don't think I've ever had any. So
I tend not to do real well with anything I have to tie, shut, and fry.
Okay.
You know, have you ever had a dolma, which is, you know, Middle Eastern stuffed grape leaf? You have to fold it over like a burrito and stuff it with herbed rice or whatever. Those things won't stay together for me.
I've never made them. I've eaten them. I love them.
Yep.
But I know there's a lot of work to that.
Well, there's another idea for your garden is grapevines. You know, not only eat the grapes, but you eat the young leaves. So.
Right. And all these climbing plants we're talking about, I mean, if you have a trellis out there, put them around it, and you'll have your own little shady spot to set under. You make a nice trellis.
Well, you can make trellises in interesting shapes as well. And,
right.
Or even, what do you call the animal shapes that are stuffed and you can grow things on? What is the name of those?
Oh, I know what you mean. Those wire things?
Right. Think about that covered in something like peas, climbing peas.
Yeah.
You know, because the pea blossoms are beautiful. They're really colorful and pretty and fragrant, and then they produce the peas for you, peas and beans.
Right. And we're talking about things that are, you know, like that. I mean, the sculpture, so there you have another shape and another height. And,
right.
And then your trees, and then you've got the trellis over there. And this, so it's a feast for your eyes.
Exactly. And,
for
your tummy.
Yeah.
And then you know, if you do everything organically, then you know that you're not putting harmful chemicals into yourself. You're not exposing yourself to genetically modified monster plants.
Right.
I'm sorry. That was kind of biased of me, wasn't it? But
bias is okay when it comes to them.
With food?
Them, yes.
Them.
I know the word them. When it comes to Monsanto and their ilk.
I was very sad to see a report this week on Scott products, too.
Oh, I saw that. Do you want to explain that? A lot of people think Miracle-Gro is just God's gift.
Well, it's not so much the Miracle-Gro that was the problem. It's the Ortho products.
Right.
That kill the bugs that we're trying to keep off our plants. And, you know, if you're spraying this on your vegetables and your fruit, then you're ingesting it. I don't care how well you wash things. It gets into the flesh of the...
Right, it's into it.
And they were using illegal pesticides. They've been fined the highest fines ever for spraying non-licensed pesticides or including them in their products. And they've been blamed for the die-off of many of the wild birds because they coated their seeds with it, the wild bird seed.
Exactly.
Bugs are hatching. So everybody's wondering lately why all the birds are dropping dead. Well, guess who we can blame? And it breaks my heart to see these companies sacrificing the life of our natural resources, our animals and our creatures, and the health of our children.
Right.
They're starting to link
a
lot of this stuff. For profit.
For profit.
You know, when you die, you can't take it with you. Why are you so intent
on
building
I don't understand how, you know, most of those fat old people and younger whatever, but, you know, they have children or they have grandchildren or they have nieces or grandnieces or nephews that they supposedly care about.
Not if they're destroying the environment. I mean, what are they going to leave
these people
living?
That's what I'm saying. How can they be so, you know, head up their ass to think that it's not going to affect them or their people?
Right. Well, these are issues I don't understand, but I'm one of those strange people. I've never been about money. You know, if I'm making enough to keep a roof over my head and food in my belly, then I'm pretty content. I'm not into gadgets and things and toys. And what gives me joy is listening to the birds and watching the butterflies and getting my feet and my hands dirty in the garden and serving a nice meal and have everyone loosen their belts and rub their tummies and knowing... Having content people and creatures around me and knowing what I've fed them has been not only grown in a healthy manner, but made with love in the kitchen. And,
Well, you know, I think there for a while, I mean, like years and years ago, there were a lot of people like that. And then there for several decades, people were push to get to gain more success. And that supposedly success meant money.
How you measure success, right?
Right.
What was that motto? Was it the 80s? The motto was "He who dies with the most toys wins."
Yes. Yes.
That's when consumerism really took off.
So sad. But you know now more people, and it's because of the economy, basically. But I think a few more people are maybe learning a little bit more about the spiritual side of things too. But more and more people are saying just what you said. That it's not that I want to be, you know, so fantastically wealthy and have all these things on the backs of people who are, you know, making $2 a day. That's not what I want. I just want to be able to surround myself with people I love and, you know, have enough to eat and do something I enjoy. My kids can go to school and be healthy. And, you know, that's what people are wanting the world over.
I'm going to share something a little personal with you. I came from a family that came from money.
Mm-hmm.
And growing up and with the sterling silver and the crystal on the table and the coming out parties and high society, I have to tell you that the people I know now that are blue collar workers, that people in my family look down their noses at, are a lot happier. There's not a lot more love in their homes.
Right.
Sure, they may not have the newest car or the fanciest gadgets. And they have to spend more time together because they can't afford to go out and send all their kids to soccer camp or whatever. But they've got closer families.
Yeah.
Now, that's changed a little bit with the crash of the economy and parents are having to work multiple jobs. But I still see tighter-knit families amongst the working class. I think that's more important. I think that's a healthier way to be.
Yeah.
But that's just my own bias. And, of course, some of these people are my neighbors that call the law enforcement on my trees. But they're learning. They certainly don't turn away the produce because I grow more than I can eat. And
right.
I've got a little green wagon that I'll fill with my produce and I'll pull it around the neighborhood and give it away. I don't believe in profiting from your neighbors. I'll sell it to someone from across the street. But if you're in my neighborhood, I share.
Yeah. Well, and, but that's what community's about. That's what we're hopefully building.
Right.
And, you know, like, you've helped a lot of people, just the people who stop and stare at your yard. And if you have the time and you go out and talk and tour them around a bit. But now you're actually going to start formally teaching again. And you have, later this month, you have a weekend.
Right. It was September 29th and 30th. I broke the lecture into 2 days because I don't want to throw too much information at people all at once. And also, some people may be more interested in the perennial landscape than the annual landscape. So on the 29th, through Tropic Plants Nursery, which is in Tamarack, Florida, suburb of Fort Lauderdale, I'll be speaking for 2 hours on how to build your edible landscape, starting with the perennials. And the beginning of the lecture, we'll talk about, I'm a big proponent of raised beds and how to create your raised bed. And I'll ask people to think about, what direction does your house face? You know, what part of your yard gets the most sun each day, which is the south-facing part.
Right.
And to look at how much space you have and what types of things you like to eat. Now, in my yard, I planted for shade because, you know, let's face it, it's brutal here in the summertime between the high temperatures close to 100 plus the humidity. We have heat ratios that are up into the, like, 115, 120 sometimes.
Wow.
And it's an amazingly intense heat. It's like walking into a wall of wet, like a wet woolen blanket when you walk out your door. And as you can imagine, cooling bills are astronomical. So I said, when I moved here 10 years ago, or 12 years ago now, I said, what can I plant that'll shade my home and feed me? So again, I'm going to send everyone back to their computers, and you'll start doing searches on what your needs are. I searched under fruit and shade and came up with trees that, like, there's a tree in my front yard. It's called a black sapote, S-A-P-O-T-E, or also known as chocolate pudding fruit.
I just love that, the whole
yeah.
idea.
Send you one. They'll be ready in January.
Okay.
Yeah, you're going to look at it and go, oh, my God, I'm going to eat this because it's black. It looks like a big green tomato, and the mother of all tomatoes. It's huge. And then you have to wait till it's so mushy that just touching it, you think your fingers are going to go through the membrane. And when you open it up, it's black. It's like dark chocolate in the consistency of pudding. And a lot of people can't get past the color and the texture, and they just want
to
eat it.
Oh, no,
yeah,
I'm there.
People look at that and wrinkle their nose and go, ew. And I have to also say it's incredibly high in fiber. You'll be, as I say, visiting the thinking room frequently.
No, because I eat tons of fiber.
Do you?
So
well,
I don't
this,
have,
this will
you know.
This will encourage you to do even more thinking. But the flavor does have a chocolate afternote, but it produces this incredibly dense shade to the point where now that the canopy covers my whole front yard, I'm trying things underneath it, figuring, what can I grow? Because I had incorporated in there, I had collard greens as a backdrop with a nice, dark green leaf, and then in front of it I'd put something like a lavender, which has a silvery leaf against the dark green black backdrop, and then I'd plant my cosmos, my calendula, and my marigolds, and those colors would just pop. I mean, the landscape just popped with bright colors, and I could go out and I could eat all of this. Well, now the shade is so dense, I can't.
You overdid yourself.
Okay, well, what can I do now? But I have found I do a lot of Thai cooking, and I grow my own kefir lime, which is essential for your Thai cooking. I've got lemongrass. I've got Thai basil. But underneath this dense shade tree, I've planted Thai ginger, which is called galangal root.
Right.
And it is thriving. It's thriving and spreading, and I'm like, well, thank goodness. I found something I can grow there. So now I've transplanted some of my turmeric. And almost everyone in the United States uses turmeric at one time or another, those of us who like to cook, and it's that orange powder that you buy. Well, once you've tried that stuff fresh, you're going to look at the powder and kind of wrinkle your nose at it. It's like anything else. Like once you start eating things fresh from your garden, store-bought stuff, because, you know, the herbs at the store are months and months and sometimes years off the plant.
Oh, true, true.
Yeah.
No, this summer, for the first time, I saw turmeric roots. And actually, we were on our way to a festival and stopped at a grocery store and got some. And it's different for sure from, I mean, because I throw the powder and everything, because turmeric is so good. It's good for your liver. It's good for any kind of healing.
It's good for your memory.
My husband
has fibromyalgia. And turmeric and ginger and some of the other plants are reducing inflammation in your body.
Right.
So yes. I will make a curry a couple of times a week for him. And as long as I do that, he's in control. He doesn't take medications. He may take a painkiller every now and then. He'll have a flare if I don't make the curry with the fresh turmeric and ginger and some of these other spices, cumin and coriander. So it really is worth the while. And some things, the people further north, you'll need to put in pots. And you can plant things in a clay pot and bury the pot up to the rim. And it'll have the benefit of being in the soil in your yard. But you can lift that and put it in your garage or somewhere that's warmer through the winter and overwinter your plants that would otherwise freeze.
Right.
Which is one way. And you can also move them around your garden without worrying about disturbing the roots.
Yeah.
So, I've got this little patch of this over here rather than there in the garden this year.
Well, and sometimes, and you know, with the herbs, I mean, there's some of them that it's really usually suggested to do them in pots like this because they spread so much, some things will just take over. And
well, I have my Haitian basket vine is eating the side of my house.
Oh, okay.
It's a vine that, and as the name implies, grows in Haiti, but it used to be indigenous to South Florida, and all the development has really pushed it almost to extinction in Florida. And it's a very important food crop in Haiti. You eat the leaves, and they're very high in nutrients and minerals. It is one of those things you have to boil and pour off the water a couple of times before you can eat it.
Ah.
But it's got this wonderfully comforting, earthy flavor to it. But then you take the vine at the end of the year and cut it back, so it looks like you have a tangle of sticks.
Mm.
And then you use those tendrils, which can be up to 30 feet long, to weave baskets.
Wow.
So if you're a crafty person, you can grow this all year and munch on the leaves. And then when things start to die back for the winter, you cut it way back, let the tendrils dry a little bit, soak them in water once they're dry, and then weave them into a basket that you can then stuff with your homemade oils and mustards and sugars.
And a wonderful present for people, yeah.
I used to
Or make a wreath or something.
Or make a wreath, and
So, I love plants like that you use everything.
Use everything.
Yeah.
And then of course, if you're further north like you are and you dig up you raise the pot that you've planted your basket vine in because it's going to freeze and die, and move it to a warmer part of your house where you can nurture it through the winter, and you don't water it that often, you just keep it slightly moist it doesn't, damp off on you. But you can bring a lot of subtropicals through northern winters by doing that. And, of course, by mulch, some of the things you can mulch the heck out of to keep warm. So
I wondered if you would – I know that you don't do this, but you, you're aware of CSAs.
Maybe not.
No? Community Sustained Agriculture?
Oh, okay. Yes, okay.
Yeah. Do you want to
– alphabet soup on me, and I'm just – I've been reporting alphabet soup government agencies all day, so my –
Right.
My brain's not working.
I neglected to say Lisa Bolivar is a reporter, and you can read her work different places. We're going to have her on sometime talking about that and what she's run into, but that's a whole other story.
I'm trying to reinvent myself as journalism has gone the way of the dinosaur in this country. and a lot of people probably nodding their heads, there's no such thing as journalism in the United States anymore. But I'm going to try to do some book writing. I'm working on a recipe book. It's called Around the World in 80 Recipes, and I'm collecting recipes from housewives from all over the place. I want comfort meals, and I'm going to be able to talk about culture and the parent culture. And those of us who like to cook things from around the world will learn about these different cultures through my book, hopefully.
Yeah, that's great.
And then you're going to you're going to be giving me my own show. I thought.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and I'll be interviewing experts who know more than I do.
Right. You know,
I'm really more at I'm better at interviewing people. I'm not used to being on the spot here, like talking like we are.
You're good. You talk. You're fine.
Okay.
But I did want to touch on the CSAs. Community sustained agriculture is very good if you live in a more of an urban area,
right,
and don't, for whatever reason, even if you grow some things, you're probably not going to be growing everything you need.
Right.
But these are farms that they're just out of town, usually within a, I'd say 50-mile radius or something, usually.
Mm-hmm.
And you pay a monthly fee. You may pay it, I think you pay it every year.
Right.
And
there's a couple of those here.
Yeah. And so you will get, sometimes depends on how it's set up, you will go out and actually you can help, and then you will get a reduced rate. You can do some of the farming. But otherwise, there will be drop-off points in your city where they come with a big box every week or every month or however the contract is.
Right, the co-op with shared produce.
Oh, wonderful, wonderful produce. I mean, I've never been involved in one. I've just heard about them from people who were and read about them. And it just sounds wonderful. And
well, it is wonderful. Or you come together for a community sale. We have community farmers markets, or they call them green markets here, where you sell your produce. But, you know,
right,
there's a move,
yeah,
there's a move in Washington, backed by the wonderful people who are coming out with all this good GM stuff, to make that illegal. And it's already, it's already been some success in saying that you can't, you can't share your homemade jams and jellies. And
well, now, that is no surprise. That has been something I've wondered about for years and years and years because, you know, I grew up in a mom-and-pop store, and I know that some counties, I lived in a county that was stricter than most other counties in the state, but a lot of that depends on the county and their strictness, but a lot of places, just like shelters for the homeless, sometimes they can only bed them and give them like milk and little cartons and cookies that are already packaged or something,
right,
depending on the place and how it rates with the city and the county and all this with code enforcement. And I've been amazed sometimes at farmers markets, the things that they do let people sell. I mean, you know, the ladies get up at 3 a.m. and bake bread and bring it, which is wonderful. And I mean, I'm never afraid to buy those things. But, you know, they're starting to crack down. They were some time ago in certain areas on that. So I'm not surprised.
Yeah, it's we really need to wake up.
Yeah.
And you know, take responsibility for our own actions. If you decide you're going to buy something from somebody and it's a canned good, you're taking responsibility on yourself that, well, if it wasn't done properly, then it's my fault.
Right.
And so that not everyone's not afraid to produce something that may not be good. You know what I'm saying? If you know what I'm saying, the botulism, whatever. But you learn how to look for the signs that it hasn't been canned properly.
Right. There's probably some things, and I mean, I would just look at the people, too. And, I mean, there's things like that, but as far as if they won't let you buy these things, then you get a group of people together and you barter and you trade back and forth.
Right, well, one of the reasons I want to start this sustainable neighborhood mentality is, you know, my neighbor may have more sun in her yard. So she can grow things I can't. I grow things that she can't. And
right.
Hey, I've got avocados right now literally falling on my head out there.
Can
I have some of your
in.
Squash?
Just
would you like an avocado?
Just rub it in because...
Uh-oh, do you like avocado?
I never met an avocado I didn't like.
Do I need to mail you? I've got three kinds.
I've
got the Florida pear-shaped avocado. I've got the one that looks like a a softball on steroids. And then I've got a Haas avocado in my front yard. This is the first year we've had the Haas produced for us.
Somebody told me the other day.
In Indiana that gets shipments of star fruit and avocados every year.
Wow. Somebody told me the other day they didn't like avocado, and I almost fell over.
Well, they don't know how to eat it.
Really?
Yeah, there's so many people who have no idea how to eat an avocado. You know, so how do you eat your avocado?
If I'm by myself and not afraid somebody's going to call me a pig, I just eat it. I mean, I peel it, but I can go through an avocado in no time.
You just eat it by itself without anything on it?
Yeah. An ex of mine used to, well, he put salt on everything. He loves salt on him. But I just like it like it is.
Do you have a Hispanic population near you?
Yeah. We have avocados.
Go into your Hispanic store and see if they've got a spice that's called pico de gallo.
Okay.
Which is red pepper and lime and a couple of other things in it.
Right. You know, I'm not, now that is not, I like everything that's in that, but I'm not real big on that, the combination.
Oh, that's too bad, because I love that sprinkled on my avocado with a squeeze of lime.
Yeah.
And I don't use, we don't use too much salt in this house.
I don't use salt. My brother loves that, and he has got this whole, the seasoning. I'm not very, much for that. But you know,
have you ever spiced it and put it on one of your veggie burgers?
No. I would just put like red pepper and chili powder. Both are good on something you may not be growing. Cantaloupe.
Yum.
They're great. Just like on coconut, you know, because I had that in Mexico on coconut, and it was like, oh yeah, I'm there. But no, my avocados are just plain and wonderful.
Well, I like them chunked with fresh tomatoes from the garden and sweet onion.
Oh, sure.
And a little bit of balsamic vinegar. You try it like that.
That was when I used to, before I became vegan, when I was a vegetarian, eating cheese. I loved the tomatoes and, fresh tomatoes from the garden and basil leaves and mozzarella cheese with balsamic vinegar.
Now, we were going to talk about gardening, and we end up talking about food. I guess it's one and the same. Because why garden if you're not going to eat it?
Well, that's it. You can't. It's very hard to do one without the other. And
right.
And your whole yard, like you were talking some about flowers and all, but basically you were talking about the blossoms from that you would eat or use from something that you're actually growing to eat the leaves or the roots or something of, because you don't plant a lot of flowers just for the sheer beauty.
Now and then something will catch my imagination. I say, oh, that's pretty, and I'll plunk that in. But it's totally surrounded by edibles.
Yeah.
And then, as I said, I've got scratch and sniff plants that the children of the neighborhood will come by just to pinch a leaf and sniff, like a bay rum tree, which is what they make Old Spice aftershave out of.
Yeah.
And the scented geraniums, and I've got patchouli, and you don't eat patchouli, but if you throw it in your bath water, I tell my neighbors you'll stink nice, you know.
Oh, patchouli. Well, that's one of those from the hippie days that...
A lot of us
love patchouli for all kinds
of
reasons.
Love patchouli, and it's so strong in the garden. After a rainstorm, all you smell in my front yard is the patchouli.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. But I've got things growing, and again, I'm subtropical. And
yeah.
Anyone who has zone 11, 10, 9, and some into 8 can grow some of these things. I've got chaya, C-H-A-Y-A, which is a shrub that my shrubs out front are taller than I am. And this is one of the most popular vegetable crops in Mexico, used with tamales.
Mm.
You have to boil it, or it's got a little toxicity to it raw. So again, you've got to know what you're growing and what can be eaten raw and what needs to be cooked. I've got two kinds of edible hibiscus, and a lot of people are familiar with hibiscus being edible. Not all hibiscus is, but I've got something called a cranberry hibiscus that is used in red zinger tea, if you're familiar with that tea in the grocery store.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But I eat the leaves. The leaves are bright red, kind of a cranberry red. And I chop those into salad with slivered almonds and fresh carambola or star fruit from my tree. And then you drizzle a little bit of honey across the top of that.
Well, doing that, using all this variety, you know, and you're just chopping leaves from here and there, but, I mean, you know what you're doing. But you get a lot of the trace minerals and things that
we
don't get. And if people are eating processed food from the box, you're not getting anything. But it's your junk.
Yeah. So you want to improve your health. The short end of it is, and I know we're coming up on an hour here.
Yeah.
The short end of it is try to move your diet to whole foods. And when I say whole foods, I mean fresh vegetables. If you can't get fresh, local grown vegetables, then go for frozen.
Yeah.
I know a lot of people don't know this, but the longer a vegetable is off the plant, the more nutrients it loses.
Mm-hmm.
So actually your frozen vegetable section in your store, whether you're going to an organic store or not, your frozen vegetables are going to be better for you many times than the fresh vegetables in the fresh produce section, because with each day that those vegetables sit there, they lose more nutrients. Whereas the frozen vegetables are frozen immediately after being harvested.
Right. And so, canned are really the worst. I know a lot of people are trying to get some canned goods in for preparations for earthquakes, power outages, things like that. But remember,
survival supplies is one thing.
Yeah, exactly. Your canned vegetables are not full of nutrients at all.
But you do your own canning. Grow your own things and can them yourself, and you know they're canned in a healthy manner, and you don't have all the preservatives in them.
Well, right, and then they'll be in glass, which is much better.
Yeah,
than
how hard is that to do? It's really, and it's fun.
Yeah, but then they're not in the aluminum, and
exactly.
Which is not good anyway for you. So there's a lot of things that we can do, and yes, we'll be announcing down the road, because Lisa's going to have her own show. And she'll be talking more and more about these particular issues.
Well, I want to encourage anyone listening who's interested, if you're on Facebook, go ahead and like my page, Heirloom Herbs and Edible Flowers. And a lot of people have liked me. It's only been up a week, and I've got, 50, I think, people?
Yeah, yeah.
Which is, I think it's pretty good, because I haven't done any advertising. But don't just lurk. You know, say, I live so-and-so, and I want to grow this, and what can you suggest? And let me talk to you about, make some suggestions of what you can plant. If you're heading into the winter, then now's the time to plan for the next growing season. And a lot of the fruit and nut trees and shrubs that you can grow in the more northern climates should be planted while they're dormant. So when they wake up and the weather warms, they wake up in their new home.
Well, and that's what we didn't talk too much about, but now you were talking about being subtropics, and where I am, the zoning is changing because of the weather.
Climate change that no one admits to, right?
Yeah, but actually somebody had sent me a zoning map that it did have it changed a little bit. So, you know, and Chicago had started planting trees that were more that we would think of the southern states, because that's the one thing that Chicago, when Mayor Daley was there, really they were thinking ahead, and they've got more green rooftops than any place, and you know, I mean, they started planting different kinds of trees because they say, you know, 50, 60, 70 years, those are the trees we're going to need.
Right.
So,
well, we do have to look ahead.
Yeah. So maybe check, see if the, call your extension agents and see if they have changed or if they have an idea. I mean, if you're in a borderline for a zone, you might want to check
it
out.
And zones aren't hard and fast. But,
no,
you know, you can flex it. You may have to, a plant that grows full sun further north, I have to plant partial shade here.
Yeah.
So
that's it. You have micro areas in your own yard.
Right.
And that's
in Florida, that's especially true.
Yeah.
You can go 20 feet and have a totally different ecosystem.
Yeah. So it's really interesting, and it's fun. I mean, everybody who gets out there and grows something that they can actually eat and share with people, they seem to have a little different outlook on life. So I think it's a real good thing to get involved in.
Well,
and for your health.
Closer to the earth, better health, right?
Yeah.
Community building.
Yeah.
Healthier kids.
All of these things.
What are you objecting to? Why are you calling the cops on me, you know? then the cops show up and say, oh, can I have some of that? You know, it's
yeah, we'll see.
So, Lisa,
I want to thank you so much. And we'll post the heirloom herb and edible flowers.
And the and is an ampersand.
Right, exactly.
Right.
So, thank you very much.
Well, thanks for having me.
And we'll be talking soon, and we'll have you back on.
Sure. Have a good evening.
Hey, bye-bye.
Bye.
What makes it different? You pull out the energy that is no longer necessary, that is stagnant in the body before you bring in the energy that does the literal healing. So whether it's quantum touch, quantum healing, or many other ways of energy work out there, I feel that they're all legitimate. They're all extremely helpful in healing.
Excellent. Who do you feel would most benefit from energy work? Is there a particular type of client or a particular, you know, kind of ailment that's most beneficially affected by energy work, or is it open-ended?
Everybody needs energy work because energy work, you can use it for the physical as well as the emotional. If a body, for instance, is not balanced, we're going to start suffering in with one issue or the other. It could be physical, it could be emotional. So energy work is something that every human being should treat himself to every now and then. For instance, the balancing of the chakras. That's the beginning. That's where the energy flows from one chakra or one point of your body to the next, to allow the energy to flow freely throughout your body. So whether you have cancer or kidney stones or a herniated disc, you're suffering from depression, or you just need to relax, you've been having a hard time lately sleeping, energy work really goes into every point of the body. Because, again, the person actually itself, let's say I would do an energy session with you, Michael.
Mm-hmm.
The healer ultimately would be you. Because after I assisted in the transfer of energy, the person itself that now regains the energy, he or she is the healer. Because he or she is the one that has taken the energy to get better. And quite frankly, you can use energy work. I couldn't say that it's better for one thing or the other. I have seen through the years the success with energy work in many different instances in life.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Maria, what are chakras and how do they play into this whole thing?
Well, chakras is an invisible point of invisible points of energy that we all have, certain points of our body. And those chakras are very essential to always keep them clear, nice, and healthy. So that the let's say we start with your root chakra. Your root chakra is the lowest chakra. Work our way to the sacral chakra, the solar plexus, which is in our tummy, up to the heart chakra, which is close to the heart, the throat chakra in our throat. Third eye between the eyebrows, our crown chakra, which is above our head. Those are all invisible points that, of course, they're not going to show on an x-ray, not yet. Very, very important that they produce the energy from one point to the other in order for it to distribute properly to your entire body. That also keeps our energy level well balanced, which means our immune system is going to be better, and we will be able to fight things that may be starting to go wrong within our bodies to keep it nice and healthy and clear.
Mm-hmm.
So chakras are very important.
So it sounds to me like an energy practitioner works with the subtle energies of the human body, and as you work to balance those energies, then it also works to improve the health of the body. Is that correct?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It will raise the energy of the person in need of healing. By raising the energy to a healthier level, the body will now be able to heal itself. This is what I always say, that the true healer is not the practitioner, but the person that comes for the session.
Are there any types of extraneous, just extra tools or other implements that you can use as part of an energy healing session? Things that can amplify the energy, perhaps?
Yes, use, for instance, I use 24 to level, again, the vibrational level of the person. I also use crystals. Each crystal has its own energy vibration. And for me, crystals are like herbs. There's a crystal for pretty much everything to help you to raise your vibrations, to feel better. And I also use what is called a biomass, which is full of amethyst crystals and works with infrared. So yes, many energy workers will use tools to assist as well with the energy session. Tuning forks and crystals are great aid.
Now, you mentioned earlier that energy is everywhere, and we all, to some degree, have access to energies. Do you feel that anyone could potentially learn to work with energies, or is it for the skilled practitioner only?
No, I believe that anybody, first of all, anyone can learn energy. My granddaughter, Bethlehem, already learned how to remove a headache within minutes. So this is, it's very simple. Like I said, we were born with the capabilities, or we were born to be able, I believe we were born to help each other out.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you don't feel good? Sit down for a few moments. So we were born to assist each other in getting better. So anyone can learn it. The only thing that I feel, that I know it's essential, is to have a good heart.
Mm-hmm.
It's to have a heart to desire to assist someone that is in pain or discomfort, whether it's an animal, a plant, or a human being. You got to have a balanced heart, a humane heart to do it. You have that, you're good to go. Anyone can choose which one to prefer to learn, whether it's the Reiki or quantum touch or any other way of energy work. But yes, it's available and it's teachable to everybody.
Can an energy worker do harm to a client?
Well, that's a good question. Energy is not capable of causing harm.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Energy is energy. It is not capable of hurting anyone. However, if you have someone that comes into your practice, let's say, and it has extremely emotional issues, I feel that the practitioner should spend some time getting to know this client or friend,
mm-hmm.
Making sure that this person is absolutely relaxed and comfortable before you do a session with anything that is associated with, with an extremely bipolar or schizophrenic. They will also benefit from the energy session.
Okay.
But the practitioner needs to approach it with extra more time and ask him more questions.
Okay, great. What would be a typical session if a client were to come into you as a first-time patient or client? What should they expect?
Well,
what would the encounter be like?
What should they expect? Actually, I'm not sure how to answer, but they should. I have a hard time knowing what they would expect.
what do you expect?
Well, sometimes, but I don't always get it. They should expect, they should expect that when they are done with the session, they should truly feel extremely relaxed, feeling lighter, feeling almost like they lost weight, all burden is removed from them. You do feel very relaxed, very light. You feel wonderful, and the energy usually lasts between 4 or 5 days. If you're a spiritual person, perhaps it will last longer. We can also maintain it longer with thoughts. With our thoughts of feeling good, our thoughts of appreciation. So what they can expect is to feel when the session is over, wonderfully relaxed.
Okay. But in the session itself, is it like going to a massage therapist? I mean, what actually happens in the session? They've never been before. Are they going to have to take their clothes off? Do they have to lay down? What actually happens when they're working with you in your practitioner space?
Well, as far as clothes, you keep your clothes on. The only thing that we ask is that you remove metal and leather because it does affect the energy work a little bit. Leather belongs to a living creature, okay? And so leather, if you have leather on, the leather literally tries to revive itself.
Oh my goodness.
It absorbs the energy as to wanting to live again. So the leather is going to keep a lot of that energy. And metal is almost like a bouncing back and forth. So clothes is, yes, you definitely keep your clothes on.
Energy knows what it needs to do.
Absolutely, it does, yeah.
individuals can do on their own to, I don't know, either keep their chakras clean, to keep their energy, to keep their vibration up, things they can do sort of as, you know, preventative energy work, if you want to call it that. Are there things that people can do on their own?
On their own, yes. Meditation is very important, okay?
Mm-hmm.
If you can take the time out to meditate, take a few deep breaths, think of where you need your healing, and just believe. Just believe.
Mm-hmm.
Put your hands, let's say, your heart is racing out of control today. Take a few deep breaths. Take a few moments to meditate. And lay your hands where you feel your body is in need of healing. And trust that you yourself can also, direct that energy towards yourself. Like I said before, everybody is born a healer.
Mm-hmm.
They just need to learn how to tap into it.
Mm-hmm.
That even you yourself can do it in a quiet moment.
Mm-hmm.
By laying hands on yourself. And of course, for those that are interested, if they learn, it would be even more phenomenal. Again, I believe that we were born to help each other out.
Mm-hmm.
To bring each other comfort,
mm-hmm.
whether it's emotional or physical, to be able to exchange this energy, because we're all connected. The energy all comes from the same place. And yes, you can heal yourself. I do energy work on myself.
Really?
So, yes.
Will energy work also work for animals or for pets?
Absolutely. I've done a lot of energy work with animals. In fact, animals are wonderful because they trust you more than a person would. And I understand that a person would be uncomfortable. They're coming to me. They've never had a session. Am I going to feel comfortable? Is she going to touch me? What's going to happen? An animal is just most animals immediately willing. And the minute, even if they're nervous, if they allow you the first few seconds, they start to relax because animals are more sensitive and more intuitive since they don't use the intellect the way we do. They're more intuitive than humans are. And usually when they bring an injured or sick animals, they know, I can tell intuitively that this animal knows Maria is making me feel better. So, yes, I even do energy on my plants when they're not looking too good.
Oh, really?
I've kept the rose one time for about a month and a half. Just as an experiment, doing energy work. And the day I went to work, and I forgot to do it when I came home.
It went plop.
Yes, it was like, okay, I've done it beyond my time. But yes, you can use it on pretty much anything that has energy to heal.
Is it possible to give your energy, say, to, I don't know, let's say an inanimate object, like a book or a keepsake or something, and then give that to somebody to have a positive effect on them? Is that a possibility of a way of using energy?
Yes. Again, if you can do long-distance energy with your thoughts,
mm-hmm.
and direct to a certain place, I've done energy on lettuce. Okay. I charge my food when I go to restaurants. I charge my water. In other words, if I'm not, you know, I drink certain waters, and I know that when you go to a restaurant, it's really not good water. I don't want it to make me ill. I charge my food with energy, and I charge my water as well. I've done it with lettuce. You know, if you send a letter and you're not sure, you can have a feeling that this person may not receive the letter in good spirits. I charge the letter with positive energy.
So you can
use energy for many, many things.
Right. So it really is a multi-purpose tool that I guess, you know, anybody can really learn to utilize in their own lives.
Absolutely, yes.
Do you, for folks that are interested in learning more about how to do energy work, Is this something that you teach to the public?
There are many Reiki masters and quantum touch practitioners, pranic practitioners all over the U.S. and Europe. I myself, am a Reiki master, so yes, I teach Reiki, and I also teach quantum touch.
Terrific. Excellent. Well, we're getting close to the end here, but I want to ask you one more question. Can you relate to us one or more instances that come to mind where you have been working with a client and you really were able to see over the course of time that you worked with that client, or even if it was just the one time, where you really, you know, you saw something, some really wonderful healing that you would like to tell us about?
Wow, this part, let me see. For instance, with a client of mine that they were going to do, remove the ovaries, do major surgery. She had a cyst that was this size, a little bigger than a good sized lemon. She had actually And she was going to do surgery, and of course, we never recommend anybody not to see a doctor. In fact, oftentimes I do recommend that they get tests done. But in this case, I had asked her if she was willing to do at least 5 to 6 sessions before her surgery, before the operation. By the time they she got checked again, it was small. It was about the size of a chickpea.
Wow.
It had reduced itself to that size. So, you know, this extreme surgery of taking the ovaries out, which is really very, it's extreme for a woman,
yeah,
was no longer necessary. I see, and of course, as a Reiki practitioner, or whatever energy work you do, we never know how far it's going to reach.
Right.
We're honest about it.
Right.
We don't know. You know, we know that it's going to work quite well. To what point, we're never sure. So I've had my moments of what I call my wonderful miracles. And of course, this is not me producing the effect. This is the energy and the person itself.
Right.
From straightening hips, of balanced hips with quantum touch within a matter of 3 to 4 minutes. Without to say it's impossible, you cannot straighten hips without surgery, but it can be done.
Mm-hmm.
Straightening the spine out and completely straight spine with people that were going to have, again, major surgery, back surgery. So through the years, I've seen wonderful results. Yeah.
That's incredible. Well, Maria, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today and for telling the audience about energy work and seeing how it really is. Good evening, everyone. Welcome again to